620 WGN. John Hanson in for Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on this, well, at least downtown, kind of dreary Saturday afternoon. The sun was peeking out for just a little bit and seems to have gone back behind the clouds. But I heard Bob mention the large difference in temperatures between downtown and the suburbs. Wish we get a little warmer downtown. Maybe we will at some point. John Hanson in for Amy Guth, as I mentioned. We got a pretty packed show today. In a little bit, we're going to be talking about new movies coming out. And obviously, the focus of so many people are on these big comic book movies, these giant movies that have the big releases, the big casts, the Star Wars, the Han Solo movies, but there is a niche market for documentaries, movies. The RGB documentary doing really, really well. It's not comparing in terms of total box office to the big ones, but there certainly is some money to be made, and people certainly are going out to see these movies, so there is a market for it. We're going to be chatting about that a little bit later on. Also talking about middle management. Are there too many middle managers? Are there not enough? A lot of businesses are kind of shaking up how they organize their businesses. A lot of that is being prompted by the rise in tech companies and a new structure where even the lowest guy in the totem pole could reach out to the CEO and offer their commentary or ask questions. But is that too much? Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? I'd love you to weigh in if you'd like to chime in on the text line, 312-981-7200, with any thoughts that you might have. And I also want to prompt this up, obviously everyone focusing on one wedding today, the one across the pond. But it's a Saturday, we're in the Midwest here, I bet there's a lot of weddings. Maybe you're on your way to one right now. Go ahead and give the bride and groom a shout out. I'd love to share some of the weddings that are happening in the area, 312-981-7200. It's not just the royal wedding today. Let's give some shout outs to some couples that are over here getting married as well. Would be happy to do that. But I wanted to talk first about robocalls. It's John Williams mentioned this with me while we were chatting back and forth about how we had thought that at some point that Congress had kind of gotten a grasp on robocalls. But apparently that's not the case. There are more and more robocalls happening every single day. And the people that are making these calls are getting craftier about how they're going to be able to get you to pick up. So reading a column in the Detroit Free Press, some days you cannot pick up the phone without running into yet another fraudster demanding money. Maybe it's not a bad idea just to avoid unknown callers. A lot of people do that. But a lot of us work in businesses where strangers might be calling us. I know, Griffin, you're booking guests all the time. I got a lot of PR people that call me or guests that call me. So I like to pick up the phone if I can. But the one technique that I've noticed a lot more and what works on me is that they're now able, through technology, many robocallers, to actually make it look like they're a local phone call. Griff, if you notice that, you're getting a lot of 630 or 312 or 773.
In the past few months, especially, I feel like I've noticed it too. When I saw this column, I was like, you know what? I get a lot of calls from numbers, not just the area code, but the rest of the number kind of looks like my number.
Yes. And I thought I thought I was going crazy at first because I'm a 630 area code on my cell phone. I won't give you the next three, but they keep on coming up. Just the last four digits are scrambled. And I knew it. You know, I'm well aware. I'm woke to the scam. So I usually don't pick up on those. But many people do. And many folks out there listening might be picking up on some of these phone calls as well. Many of these calls coming from debt collectors, according to UMail. But robocalls are being sent by fraudsters who make it look like the call is coming from you. The FCC approved a $120 million fine recently, earlier this week, against Adrian Abramovich, who was doing business as a marketing strategy leader, which initiated, get this, 96.8 million fraudulent robocalls for vacation deals. He lives in Florida. He says he hasn't done anything wrong. And the firm used this, quote, neighborhood spoofing, that's the technology they call it, to make it seem like the calls were coming from local areas. But this revolt is rising against robocalls. Democratic leaders in Washington are introducing various bills to stop robocalls. But I guess the question is, can you really? And while you're working to stop these robocalls, there's a lot that consumers can do to avoid them. So here's some scams to watch out for. Many of you probably know a few of these. It's just sometimes good common sense, but it helps to hear some of the scams so that you're able to recognize it when you're picking up on the other line. If you are picking up in the own area code, that's obviously this fake call from a neighbor. That's something that people have been doing. There's fake utility bill collector. So I think a lot of people are familiar with the IRS scams where it makes it sound like the IRS is collecting money. The government's going to come get you if you don't pay your bills. But when in fact, they are not, of course, doing that. It's unpaid bills. So some scams have morphed into attempts into getting people to do this. DTE Energy, which is a legit energy company, had a scammer that claimed to be from DTE Energy, and they they were able to solicit thousands of dollars from someone out of Troy, Michigan, convincing him that his power would be shut off in hours if he didn't make a payment. He made a payment to this company, obviously not DTE. He made it to the scammer. And once they get you once, they're going to call back again. So first they asked for $393. He paid it. Then they asked for another $1,000. He paid that. He wised up when the third call was around $2,000, something to be aware of. We want to take one phone call. I hope this isn't a robocall. Mark, are you a robocaller?
I am not a robocaller.
But has your number been used? Tell me about your story.
My number? My number is used. I've received calls from people who call me and say, yeah, what did you want? I have no idea what their number is.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, they say, well, what do you want? You just called me. No, I didn't call them. And I think what's happening is they're using my number as their robocall. You know, it's the, like you said before, it's the same area code, same prefix, different.
So they're actually using all 10 digits of your phone number to call someone else. The person either missed it or they ignored it and they called back and it's getting to you. That's crazy, Mark. I never heard of that.
It's coming back to me, and it's happened to me a couple of times.
And you're good. You don't try and scam anyone with that then.
Well, I'm not trying to scam anybody, but I have had one guy was kind of angry about it. I had to explain to him, you know, here's what's happening.
Wow.
You know, I will not answer a phone call that has my same prefix.
Yeah, Mark, we appreciate the phone call. We got to get to break here, but we appreciate the call here on 720 WGN, and that's something I never heard of. I thought that they would all be dummy numbers, but the fact that they're actually numbers that people have, and it's a fake number. So watch out for those 0% credit card offers, fake money-making guarantees. A lot of it's common sense, but just be aware that it's happening more and more. Okay, quick commercial break, then more on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. WGN, John Hanson in for Amy Guth here on this Saturday Wintrust Business Lunch here until 1 o'clock. Just a quick shout out, I'll also be on after the White Sox game tonight, so more topics and fun there as well. I used to go to the movies a lot. I find myself going less and less. I feel like all there is, and they're great movies, and if you love them, that's fine. They're the big comic books, or it's superhero movies. So I've sworn off going to the movies pretty much for the most part. I think I went and saw The Post. That's the last movie I saw. But right now, Anne Hornaday from The Washington Post, you're going to let me know, Anne, that apparently I'm just not looking hard enough, am I?
Well, I commend you on your good taste, John. I mean, you chose if you were going to see one movie this year, God, please make it The Post.
You know what's so funny is I said that and I didn't even connect the dot that obviously I'm talking to someone from the Washington Post. And you mentioned in this headline, the summer box office big winner, Ruth Bader Ginsburg with a question mark. I had heard of the documentary. Clearly, she's not raking in more cash than some of these big movies. What makes that movie and others like it the big winners of the summer?
Well, it's all proportional. You know, these big comic book spectacles, they cost a lot of money to make, and then they cost even more money to market. But a little documentary like RBG, this utterly beguiling, compelling documentary about Ginsburg, didn't cost that much to make, but it's really punching far above its weight in terms of the box office. I think right now it's at more than $2 million, which, again, for that genre, for nonfiction films that are primarily in art houses, although I think it's now expanding into more theaters, but it's really a very impressive showing.
For
a movie of that kind of size.
The question I have, though, is, you know, obviously RBG continues to grow in prominence. The notorious RBG, people talk about it. We're obviously political centric right now. Everyone is focused, whether you're on the right or the left. Everyone's engaged in the political conversation. Is this a standalone, or is there a model to follow here for other movie makers or other movies that are coming down the pipeline soon?
Well, it's interesting. I do think it's a model. And I think one way to kind of look at this phenomenon, and it is a phenomenon, is older women. And I do think that consistently over the past few years, we've seen both big studio movies like Mamma Mia, which the sequel's coming out this summer because it was so successful. You know, all those great Nancy Meyers rom-coms with Meryl Streep and Diane Keaton, they tend to do really well with an audience that I think, like you said, with those comic book movies, is pretty underserved by mainstream Hollywood. And then you see little indies like The Woman in Gold or I'll See You in My Dreams, a wonderful romantic comedy with Blythe Danner, or Grandma with Lily Tomlin. These are all examples of that sort of small, modestly budget film that ends up overperforming at the box office. They call it overperforming, and it is extremely profitable, you know, because they succeed in reaching their audience and that core audience of older women. And I think that's the constituency that showed up for RBG last weekend, for Mother's Day weekend, and they brought their daughters and they brought their granddaughters. So it's a real multi-generational success story.
I wonder also if what you're kind of getting at here is that studios or filmmakers, you can be smart about it. You can find a topic that will captivate people, and you can put it in the right places to be able to maximize your bang for your buck.
Absolutely. I really do think it comes down to knowing exactly who your audience is. And I do think, you know, you mentioned the political atmosphere right now. And RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, even if you don't agree with her ideologically, I think you can admire her. You know, you can admire her career. You can admire, much of this movie is really a love story between her and her late husband, Marty, who was so supportive. And her friendship with Antonin Scalia, you know, so it's not a hyper-partisan movie. It's actually a movie about a transcendent figure, someone who actually transcends this petty partisanship. And it's kind of healing, you know, it's kind of a relief to be able to go in and just sort of admire someone. I would say the same thing for a movie that opened this weekend here in D.C., Pope Francis. That's another example of a figure who I think just everybody loves him because he just, regardless of whether you're a believer or what your denomination is, you can admire this guy, and he kind of brings us up out of the petty partisanship that we find ourselves in now.
You mentioned RBG's success maybe partly based on the political culture, also the idea of older women going to wanting to see this movie. But that movie really is connecting with a new generation, perhaps, that is discovering her story for the first time.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, that's where that notorious RBG came from, is this younger generation really just taking her on as an avatar of grit and determination intellectual courage. And she became a meme and a hashtag and went viral and all these things, you know, that are kind of part of this new social media age. And they're doing it with other, you know, she's not the only one. I mean, I think Madeleine Albright can claim avatar status in that way. People like Maxine Waters. I would say the late Barbara Bush qualifies as somebody, again, who kind of transcends the usual divisions so that younger women can just look up to these people and these women who forged a path for them, and they recognize it and they acknowledge it. They pay homage to it in the form of, you know, whether it's Kate McKinnon on Saturday Night Live or a viral hashtag about notorious RBG. So, yeah, she's really, and now of course this movie with its success is kind of vaunting her into a whole other area of pop culture success. It's really quite fascinating.
Not only can documentaries kind of find their market and be able to make money, but one with even big names. You mentioned in your article and your column, Book Club with Diane Keaton, Jane mm-hmm. Fonda, Candace Bergen. These are big names. That's obviously going to have a bigger budget, not necessarily as big of a budget as one of the Avengers movies, but is that a matter of, again, finding the stars that you know will get people out and telling stories that you know will get the right demographics out, even if it does cost a little bit more money on the front end?
Absolutely. And again, I think this is still relatively modestly budgeted, you know, compared to those big spectacles. And if the studio can find that audience and make sure they know about this movie, I was kind of hoping, I did a little research asking, did they put trailers for Book Club in front of RBG?
Right.
If they are not doing, they should do, and vice versa as RBG expands. I mean, because it's the same demographic, and they are hungry. I mean, they have proven over and over again that not only are women hungry for these stories and they will reward you by going to the actual movie rather than wait for it to stream, but another aspect of, I think, women's power in the marketplace is kind of being decision makers at home, whether it's deciding what the kids are going to see or often, I don't know about you, but often it's the women who will tell the husband, oh, if this looks good, let's go see this on Saturday night. So, you know, again, I just think Hollywood, they do have a habit of, I think, valuing women as we're younger and more sexually available and, you know, sexy and all of that. But they really do leave money on the table when they don't acknowledge us, you know, later in life in terms of both subject matter and a market.
And it's a fascinating conversation. We could probably chat for the entire hour about it. But we are out of time today. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Winter's Business Lunch.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, John.
And I'm glad I gave the Post a shout-out without even knowing it. It worked out really well.
Thanks for that, too.
Absolutely. More Winter's Business Lunch after this on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining me today. John Hanson in for Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Earlier this month, Spotify began implementing new policies to remove controversial or quote-unquote hateful artists from promoted positions throughout its platform, and that is causing a bunch of different issues. And here to break it down from Gizmodo is AJ Dellinger. And AJ, before we get to that, because that is fascinating and we're going to have that discussion, I asked our producer Griff to get the pronunciation of your last name, and you said you go with either Dellinger or Dellinger. Which one is it, man?
You know, I'm not in a position to be picky, however you want to pronounce it.
We get that a lot in radio and I work at TV, too, and they say, oh, however you want it. But there's got to be, like, the accepted way, right? Like, that the family goes by officially, right?
I suppose Dellinger is probably
all right.
The
okay. All right. I don't know why that that irked me, but I'm like, I got to figure it out. I want to give you the way that you want it to be said. Anyway, so this opened a whole bag of worms. This when they took R. Kelly off their promoted list on Spotify, and I know that there were discussions about, oh, this is censoring stuff like that. But can you break it down for everyone? This isn't removing the artist completely from the platform, right?
Correct. It's simply removing the artists from any of Spotify's curated playlists, any of the promoted positions that you might see throughout the app. You can still find the artists on Spotify. You can still listen to their music, but they aren't promoted by Spotify.
And did Spotify give any reasoning for why now, why they decided to do this? Is it just part of the growing wave of people, like, obviously against people that have had, you know, sexual misconducts or stuff along those lines? And have they targeted any other artists, or is it R. Kelly? Have they? There's obviously a lot of names out there that come to mind for people.
Yeah, there have been a couple different artists that got hit with this, R. Kelly being the highest profile by far. It seems like this has been just kind of Spotify codifying some ideas that it's had as a company for a while into an actual policy. But for the most part, it doesn't seem like it's been applied in a widespread manner yet, or at the very least, they just haven't announced the artists that have been hit by it. R. Kelly, obviously, because of how big of a name he is, was noticed essentially immediately. But other than that, I don't think they released a full list,
right,
of who has been hit by it yet, but they're working with a couple different groups that have some chops in this field. The Southern Poverty Law Center, the Anti-Defamation League, groups like that are helping them, you know, monitor content and choose which artists are going to be removed from their promoted spots on the app.
It really seems like a can of worms. I applaud them on some of their efforts here, but it's interesting. It's to, you know, what makes it someone quote unquote promoting hateful issues? Is it, you know, what laws do they have to break? What accusations? How many? It seems like obviously there'd be a lot of complications there. And one of the complications has to do with how merchandise is sold or distributed via Spotify. I didn't know that there was a connection between Spotify and merchandise. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, so back in 2016, Spotify started a partnership with this company called Merch Bar that works with a lot of different artists to sell products. That merchandise is promoted on the artist page in Spotify. If you go to an artist page and they have, you know, albums for sale, shirts, tour gear, whatever, it's all listed on Spotify, but if you go to interact with it at all, you're taken to Merch Bar, the site that actually hosts it. It's not clear if there's any actually like financial relationship between the two companies, if Spotify is getting a little percentage
or something,
of all sales from that. Yeah, the company says that they're not. There are affiliate links on those, which usually suggests some kind of at least tracking, if not, you know, percentage coming off.
Well, you got to imagine that Spotify has to benefit in some way. We don't know, obviously, if it's financially, but there's got to be some reason why Spotify would want to partner in this besides just to improve customer experience. Although that could obviously help build the Spotify brand. But why we're mentioning this is because as of right now, you can still, that R. Kelly's merchandise is still being linked there. And some people are saying, well, if you're not going to promote him and you're not going to promote his quote hateful ideas or the things that he's done, then why would you still still have that up there. Is that, and that's the gist of the article you wrote, right?
Correct. Yeah. I don't know necessarily if it's a huge issue if Spotify isn't taking a percentage of the sales, but it just does seem a little fishy that that merchandise is still up there and still being promoted. And the artist is obviously still profiting off of it, and Spotify is promoting that. It does seem a little weird.
Do you think that Spotify has mishandled this rollout of these new features, not features, but of these new rules and regulations?
I think they have put themselves in a really difficult position. I don't know that what they're doing is, you know, wrong in any way. I think, like, I don't think there's a lot of people that would disagree with their position morally. R. Kelly in particular has done some pretty abhorrent things, or is accused of doing some pretty abhorrent things. But it's just such a... it's such broad strokes and it's so difficult to apply it that it seems like you're never going to be able to satisfy everybody. There are tons of reasons to object to a person and a musician, from the content of their lyrics to their behavior as an individual. How Spotify is going to go about actually applying that seems like it's going to cause them a lot of trouble.
Yeah, and it's interesting because once they start making these decisions for R. Kelly, then other people are going to start asking them to make changes with certain others. I mean, Chris Brown comes to mind immediately for me. And you mentioned that there are now groups that are actually reaching out to Spotify saying, hey, if you're going to do it for R. Kelly, what about Chris Brown?
Right, exactly. There was a women's advocacy group that penned a letter, an open letter to Spotify, asking them to address a couple other artists. Chris Brown was on there. Eminem was on there. The Red Hot Chili Peppers, which off the top of my head, I don't know what the objection is with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, but I'm sure that there probably is a valid one.
Mm-hmm.
Can be said for all kinds of different artists.
Yeah, and I think that the other point that people were making that about the censorship, so just to recap again, if someone wants to listen to R. Kelly, there is a way to do it. You just have to kind of do it the old-fashioned way, because Spotify hasn't been around that long, but you just have to actually actively search for these artists.
Correct, and you can, you know, save their music to your library. You can add it to your own playlist. It's just not on Spotify's promoted playlist.
AJ Dellinger from Gizmodo. You can follow him on Twitter at AJ Dell or at Gizmodo. And AJ, thanks for joining us and breaking down the story for us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. We're going to be talking about middle management. I'd love for people to text in on this question. 312-981-7200. Are there too many middle managers out there? Are there not enough? Have we gotten rid of too many middle managers? Do we need more? As counterintuitive as that may seem, let us know. 312-981-7200. Give us a text. I'd really be curious about that. And we're going to be chatting about how many, many more companies are getting rid of middle managers, but it might not be as great as it sounds. That's coming up next on the Winter's Business Lunch. .720 WGN, John Hansen in for Amy Guth until 1 o'clock. Scott Catoon coming in next, and then we're going to have some White Sox baseball a little bit later on this afternoon and evening as well. And then I'll be back on again at 10 tonight. In for Guth again on the back half of the Guth Show. It's Guth Sandwich. Well, I guess no. Everything else in between would be the sandwich. I'm just the bread on this thing. Okay, I went into Google and I plugged in on my search bar War On. I wanted to see what different things came out because it seems like we have so many wars going on right now. There's a war on drugs, war on terror, war on everyone. That's the third one. War on poverty, war on peace. I think that's a misspelling there. And, of course, the war on Christmas. Everyone knows about that. I don't see anywhere on here a war on middle management. Maybe that's a war that we can all get behind, but maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we should slow down a little bit. And here to break all that down is Sam Walker, deputy editor for the Wall Street Journal. Sam, thanks for joining us here on 720 WGN.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
So what is this war on middle management? Are we seeing more and more companies get rid of middle managers, and why or what's their justification for doing so?
Middle managers have become this strange thing. It's like this pejorative term. It's like an insult now.
Right.
You know, a lot of this comes from, it really comes from the the startup culture in Silicon Valley. Everyone is racing to embrace what seems new. You know, the idea of a CEO in a hoodie and, you know, companies that are rich beyond your wildest imagination with no path to profitability. I mean, all the rules seem to have been broken. So a lot of people in traditional legacy industries are thinking, oh, well, we need a new management structure. We need to look more like these fancy, glossy startups. So what they're doing is they're, you know, really kind of eliminating that middle layer. I mean, they're trying to create the situation where the founders and the CEOs of the companies who tend to remain very involved are talking directly to the star talent, the workers, the people that are doing the most important work in the field. It's this idea that you're more nimble, there's more feedback, you're better able to react, and ideas germinate more quickly without these middle managers who are allegedly the people who are, you know, destroying ambition and, you know, creating useless bureaucracy.
Well, it's interesting. I imagine that this kind of goes line in step with the with open office concepts and shared tables, the idea that everyone is an equal. And, you know, in many ways, this sounds utopian in some ways, that the lowest person on the totem pole or the lowest ranked person can talk directly to the CEO. But I imagine there's a lot of reasons why that's not necessarily the best thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at your inbox.
Yeah, right.
Look at your Slack, you know, which just seems to proliferate. I mean, all the studies show that senior managers are, you know, they're pushing 90% of the workday communicating with people in various forms.
Just email back and forth, text, calls, that sort of stuff?
Oh, meetings, emails, you know, different modes of communication. Yeah, it's, you know, the time that they are able to spend thinking or working on a project or doing something independent is just shrinking. And this is true for all of us. I mean, collaborative activities, you know, people are spending like 50% more time over the last couple decades just interacting with other people. The problem is, there are two problems. The first is just interaction fatigue, which, you know, a lot of CEOs are complaining to me about. They just feel bombarded, and they think, you know, anyone at any level of the company feels like they can, you know, engage them, you know, on any subject, and that's a lot of, it just makes the job more difficult. But, you know, the real problem is something that happens when your company gets mature. I mean, a lot of these startups, you know, they've known nothing but this wild growth pattern, and you know, maybe it's better when you're growing like crazy to have little less middle management. The problem comes when things start to go badly and when you really need to hold the organization together, and that's when you miss that middle layer.
And it's fascinating in your discussion here, you mentioned, and I'd never heard of this argument for and promoting middle management, is this A worker and B worker thing. And I think everyone wants to think they're an A worker, but there's a lot of B workers there. Can you explain what A and B workers are and why that is an argument in favor of middle management?
Well, in general, the A level talent, now we're talking about workers at a company. Everyone is so eager to hire stars, A level people who make a huge impact, who have really big contributions relative to other people. And that's where the talent market's really hot. Now, the B players are different. B players are people who may not have star quality or may not have executive potential written all over them, but, you know, they because of that, if they're good, they've been in the company a long time, they probably haven't changed jobs, they have a very good working knowledge of everything and everyone, they spend a lot of time helping you develop talent, you know, dealing with younger people and bringing them along. They're doing a lot of the important work behind the scenes. But the thing is, when the company starts to go badly, when things start to dive, these people are more interested in the collective outcome and in the company's results than they are in their own individual advancement. So what happens? You know, the CEOs and founders and people that are very engaged, they start to overfunction. They start coming up with all kinds of ways to stop the bleeding, right? And some of them are not good. And, you know, the A players, I mean, look, you know, they're marketable. They're looking at their
resume. They're getting out of there.
Yeah, maybe I'm out of here. It's those people whose fates are tied to the results of the company that you need in those moments, because they're the people who, A, understand how the company works, you know, and B, will actually try to hold things together and try to come up with solutions that work, as opposed to, you know, either over-functioning or just thinking about their next job.
Sam, I working in media, I work in some more non-traditional roles and companies. So anytime you describe A and B workers, I'm actually trying to apply it to the show The Office, because I've seen every episode about 20 times and figure out where everyone was there. I think we might need to go to C and D workers for some of them. But Sam, I wanted to ask this. This might be a chicken and an egg question, and we don't really have an answer, but maybe you can expand on this. The idea that obviously tech companies promoting this idea of the lowest person can talk to the highest person, that's going to promote creativity and ambition and all that. Is it that more so, or is it also that millennials or younger workers want that sort of atmosphere, or do they want it because they see that the hot tech companies do that? I guess what I'm asking is part of the reason for this is because to keep millennial workers there, this is the kind of atmosphere they claim to want.
Absolutely, that's part of it. I mean, that's why it's such an easy sell. That's why Tesla this week, threw that into their reorganization memo, this idea of getting flat. It definitely appeals to that generation of workers, especially millennials who are talented that you want to retain. They just kind of chafe inside a traditional hierarchy. They're impatient. They don't really want to wait their turn. They don't necessarily want to follow an old structure and pattern of climbing up the ladder. And a lot of companies are doing interesting things. I mean, they're creating all kinds of, they're creating the chief executive officer for ping pong, so everyone has a title, so they feel like they're part of the executive team. And so, yeah, some of this is atmospheric. It's just an easier sell. And look, you kind of got to cater to this generation because they're very important right now, and they're very tech-savvy, and they're helping a lot of companies make big adjustments. So I think the problem is we're overdoing it, and we're forgetting that, you need these alpha betas, I like to call them. They're very strong people that are more interested in the collective results than they are in their own advancement.
Sam, if there's, managers listening out there, I guess the answer probably lies somewhere in the middle, providing some structure but still allowing creativity, maybe having roles that are, I don't want to say interchangeable, but are movable, or they can kind of change depending on the situation. But I imagine it's up to each company to kind of ascertain what works best for them.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, look, these companies are so different. I've spent a lot of time studying elite sports teams, and I've discovered that captains are really important and shouldn't necessarily be the star. I mean, it is that kind of middle manager. So a small team may benefit from this structure, but, some companies may not. I mean, one theory, though, which people have, I've heard now a lot in the comments on my column, is this idea of middle-up innovation. And it's the idea that, you kind of reach into that middle layer to the functional experts, these B players, to try to figure out, what's possible and what sorts of innovations they see. And that may not work for every company, but I think the real takeaway from this is we just got to spend a lot more time, making these hires and not worrying quite as much about A-level talent or the executive ranks. We've really got to focus on that middle layer and making sure those people are, they don't have to be a lot of them, but they really have to be good, and they have to be kind of selfless, more interested in the company than themselves.
Sam, I imagine, like most things, this will be cyclical. There will be waves of innovation in different ways. You'll have more middle managers, and that's just kind of the way things go, and it'll be interesting to follow. And Sam, we really appreciate your time today.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
All right, Sam Walker from The Wall Street Journal. We're going to wrap things up next on 720 WGN.